Welcome to Ad Exchanger Talks, the podcast devoted to examining the issues and trends in advertising and marketing technology that matter most to you.
This episode is sponsored by mParticle. mParticle believes that better data results in better decisions and better outcomes. mParticle can cleanse, visualize, and connect your customer data from any source or system to any API. Postmates, NBC Universal, Spotify, and Airbnb use mParticle to accelerate their customer data strategies. Visit mParticle.com to learn more.
What do you do if you're an English major? You get into ad tech, of course. Or that was the case for Patrick Miller, co-founder of Flywheel Digital, a startup that focuses on tools to help consumer product companies drive sales on Amazon. In 2018, Flywheel was acquired by Essential, the company that owns the Cannes Lion Festival. Today, Patrick is the co-president of digital commerce at Edge by Essential, which is part of Essential's retail arm. But he's also got a book club for English majors who found themselves in ad tech somehow, although I may or may not be allowed to join. He's asking for me. No reporters allowed, apparently. But Patrick's got no lack of candid takes on the retail space, Amazon, Walmart's aspirations, and retail media network FOMO. But here's a question. What even is a retail media network anyway? We'll get into that. And also why Chinese brands are taking over on Amazon. I'm Allison Schiff. This is Ad Exchanger Talks. So let's get talking. Hey, Patrick, welcome to the podcast.
Thanks for having me.
So in our email exchange over the past couple of weeks, we were hashing out what to talk about on this podcast. I learned something interesting about you, which is you are like the king of inbox zero, that you respond to all emails right away, like, or at least same day. I mean, I respond to most of my emails, but they usually start out with, so sorry for the delayed reply. I'm sorry for my radio silence. Sorry for just getting back to you, because I'm responding like days or weeks later. So how the hell do you do it?
Two small children that get me up early and go to bed very like embarrassingly early. I love getting up or like around like 5 or so every day because it's like dead quiet and so I can just like knock out emails. And then we also have like colleagues that are all over the place. So getting to juggle lots of time zones, it's easier to be synchronous with colleagues in China, at early in the morning just because it's like late in the day for them.
So are you telling me that I can answer my emails with more alacrity if I have two children?
Yes. It's the constraint. Cause I used to think I didn't have time and then I had kids and then I realized like, no, I had a ton of time then. So then it just sort of compressed and encouraged juggling and being very, very deliberate.
That's true. I always feel like I'm running out of time, not taking into consideration how much time I waste
Rule, the faster you reply to an email, the more typos you can get away with and the briefer your response. The longer you sit on the email, the more verbose you have to be. So I like to play email badminton and just knock it back over the net.
So one more little personal note about you, and then I'm going to segue us into commerce and retail. But I know that you were an English major. I was also an English major. Actually, I was an English minor and a history major. How did you go from getting an English degree at James Madison University to founding Flywheel Digital in 2014? Well,
we also have like an English major book club around people in the ad tech space. So we have some people from Pinterest, some people from Amazon, some ex-Amazon people. So, you might get an invite to that. We're meeting this evening to talk about an Atlas Huxley book that we just read. I've had a very meandering career path. I spent a time after college sort of bumming around Arizona as a bike mechanic. Worked at Olive Garden for a stint. That was wonderful. Then worked in politics for a while. Then worked for the Chesapeake Bay Foundation. And then started working in this space. And I always have been sort of nerdy and liking computers since the time that parents gave me a 286 and a 14-port modem. And it's just sort of playing around and sort of discovering this space was just fun. Like, it's just like so many rocks to kick over and figure out like how things are connected. Yeah, it's just fun. Like, it's just like, it's just interesting problems to solve. I feel like that's just sort of the joy of the space.
I would love you to write a novel about your experiences, but I want you to name names, like a Romana Clef novelized. That might be fun.
It'd be fun.
So why did Essential, which is the company behind the Cannes Lions Festival, why did they buy Flywheel? Like, when was it? It was back in 2018, I think.
They wanted to have the worst dressed person at Cannes. Hold that mantle for years running now. But they looked at, you know, sort of the growth of digital commerce saw, and even before acquiring Flywheel, had acquired the businesses that became Edge. So One Click Retail, Clavis Insights, Brandview, and RNG. Saw the growth of digital commerce and wanted to put a stake in the ground help mature that industry and drive the growth across and for consumer brands.
So speaking of acquisitions, I am curious to get your take on what Publicis is building, because first they acquired Citrus Ad, which the way I understand it, it's to help retailers launch retail media networks. That's a motorcycle going by my window, if you can hear it. It's the joy of recording in your bedroom. And then more recently, there was the acquisition of Profitero for e-commerce analytics. So why does that like make sense rather than, you know, agencies partnering with these companies, which I think is what was happening a couple of years ago? Like Profitero in particular had a lot of partnerships with agencies. They had a partnership with Dentsu's commerce arm and BMLY and R and Publicis, actually.
Yep. Yeah, I mean, I think on the one hand, it's a validation of our strategy and complementary, but it's also it's a way, I think, as folks start to figure out, you know, this space, what's important, how do they add value for brands? They're looking for ways to differentiate, you know, their offerings from, you know, what else is out there. And I think every company has a question of sort of, what do they build? What do they buy? You know, where do they partner? And where can they create, you know, unique opportunities to create value, via some of these acquisitions? And then look, I think, you know, the folks at Profitero are wonderful. Keith Anderson is a long, long time friend, thrilled for them, where this next step goes. And I think it was a very smart move by Publicis, to purchase them.
Profitero, of course. Why am I calling them Profitero?
Well, you can call them whatever you want.
I guess. It sounds like a dessert. Profitero. Profiterole. Yes. Okay. And kind of in the same vein, what do you think of what Criteo is doing, their whole, you know, about face?
Yeah, I mean, to me, all of this is it's an acknowledgement of search. And I think for a long time, you know, folks were, thinking about sort of like, how do people, you know, shop? And how do people, you know, shop specifically on the internet? And much of it is, you know, search-based. And search is the ultimate signal of, you know, both, you know, sort of, you know, purchase intent, what people are interested in. It's sort of how it leads to a browse experience. I think sort of if I look at, whether it's Citrus or whether it's, you know, Criteo, all of this is acknowledging, the power of search and how brands, value, you know, sort of this planogramming exercise, if you will. And so I think there's a misnomer in the industry that it's an endless aisle on the internet. It's not, it's actually a smaller aisle because of how small a cell phone screen is. But there are endless number of aisles, you know, i.e. there are endless number of search queries. And the search queries vary by category as far as how top heavy they are, as well as how like I would call it, like, are they clicky or scrolly, searches. And so like a really clicky search would be like a toilet paper, where it's going to be concentrated to, you know, 65% or so of the clicks to the top three items, versus like a fashion query where it's like the decay curve is almost flat. This is sort of, all of this is coming together for folks to sort of figure out how to planogram in real time.
I do like clicky versus scrolly. I hadn't thought of it that way. And yeah, I'm not really doing a lot of toilet paper comparison shopping.
No, the toilet paper math is actually some of the most complicated math in the world.
Really?
And so if you ever try to figure out like how many sheets are actually showing up on that, is a lot of mental gymnastics.
Talk to me a little bit about the toilet paper mental gymnastics. I find that fascinating.
Well, it's like a negative scarcity effect. So like the wider the toilet paper roll is, the more the people consume, which is why they make them, you know, wider and wider. And then also then being able to figure out like how many sheets are actually on it and the size per sheet. And then you can actually, if you read the Amazon reviews, you actually have people like commenting on like if they do a down count, like the number of sheets going down or if the size of the sheets change.
Oh my God, people need to watch more Netflix, get cable and save the cable industry. Good God. I will say my mom buys all of her toilet paper online. I don't. She lives in the suburbs. I, you know, live right near a grocery store. So I buy it roll by roll. But she's bought rolls of toilet paper so big that they don't fit in the little like dispenser. Like they just, it just has to sit next to the toilet because yep. It's massive. It's a tire.
Yes. Yep. Well, and also, I mean, I think it's also a key challenge for, you know, consumer brands of the unit economics of shipping it to your door. So it's like, it doesn't make any sense if you're buying a single roll, like you shouldn't put that in a UPS box and expect to make any money. Which is also sort of expressed by like the ultra fast folks and like, you know, how they're trying to build out a supply chain network, to profitably deliver, you know, convenience. And look, it's really tough as we've seen, you know, in all the cutbacks, you know, recently by some of these startups, like the CACs are just too high and the operational efficiency just isn't there.
So I want to talk a little bit about this notion that everything is an ad network, or like to put it another way, that everything can become an ad network. If it can, it will. Like eventually everything will be an ad network. At least that's this narrative you hear. And I mean, specifically on the retail side, this is an incomplete list. You have Kroger and Target and Walmart and Michaels and Best Buy and Ulta and Albertsons and Macy's and Dollar General, for God's sakes. And then a bunch, of course, that I'm not remembering. So like, why is everyone and their mother launching a retail media ad network now? And like, are we going to see more?
Yeah. So I think first I'd want to double click into like what you mean by a retail media, you know, ad network. And so are they selling, you know, placements on the site? Are they, you know, do they have a, you know, a programmatic, you know, second price or first price auction within search results? Are they creating their own DSP? Are they selling, you know, those banners, you know, on site, you know, or off site? Are they plugging into, you know, a connected TV device and then selling that? And so I think those are all sort of different critters and different ways of, you know, to go to market. But ultimately, you know, this is retail and within retail, if I go into any store, you know, brands have long paid for end caps. You know, they've long paid, some brands pay for slotting. And so these are sort of different, you know, machinations, you know, of that, you know, within sort of, you know, building on sort of auction dynamics. Why are folks doing it? I think number one, like what's interesting about sort of advertising within a retail context is it is giving brands, you know, closed loop measurement and the ability to drive growth. And if so long as it's on site, it's giving retailers, you know, EBITDA. So you're, you know, driving, you know, profit for retailers, growth for brands. And so it's a natural alignment, you know, across them.
So I'm going to double click on your double click. And so what are people talking about when they talk about retail media? Like all you hear about is people talking about retail media networks. Do they know what they're talking about? Is it just like an umbrella term now?
I think it's sloppy language. And so like, I would prefer to be a bit more precise on like, okay, what is the retailer? How is it deployed? Are they building it themselves? You know, are you buying it programmatically? Is it an auction? Is it search? Is it display? You know, is it video? You know, and then how is it sort of, you know, how is it bought and exchanged? And then who's in the middle of the stack and how does that work? So it's interesting to sort of, you know, pick that apart. And then look at sort of like how big are the various, you know, part, you know, components of this. And, you know, so, you know, search is, you know, is sort of, I would say, I read, like I saw somewhere, I think it was actually Ad Exchange, or somebody's talking about like, you know, how Amazon, no, it's Business Insider. They recently did an article about, you know, like Amazon going to Cannes. And they were talking about like, well, you know, Amazon started with search. I said, no, they didn't. They started with Adzinnia, you know, a decade ago. They started with display. It just search got really big, you know, because everybody searches before they buy. And so, you know, anyway, so I think it's important to, look, I mean, I'm aging myself, but it's important to look back at sort of the where everybody's been. And you've always been able to buy, you know, placements, you know, on, on various websites, you know, since Wired, launched the first display ad, you know, whatever it was, 25, 30 years ago, you know, retailers have been no different. You know, they've just created more self-service ways and open up more APIs, you know, for brands to create value, you know, by bidding in different ways.
On that note of sloppy language, I feel like ad tech is a big offender. Like cookieless really bothers me, the term cookieless, because it doesn't mean anything, or it doesn't mean what people are using it to mean. They're talking about, you know, the end of third party cookies, first party data. Yeah. Zero party data too, but first party data, profitero, profitero. Yeah.
Well, it's or just the idea that like, you know, data is oil, man. Data is sand. You know, data, you have a lot of data, it just means you have a big AWS bill. Like, what are you doing with it? You know, and how do you actually, you know, create value, you know, with that information? And it's the same thing with like, you know, first party data. If you don't have a closed loop as a brand, like what's the point of first party data? You know, okay, you can upload it into a clean room, match it one time, and then well, then what? And so, you know, I think if you don't have those continuous, you know, closed loops and ability to measure, it doesn't make a lot of sense. And so it's like, I hear consumer brands a lot of times talking about, you know, first party data, and they don't have a real D2C, you know, not a scaled one at least. And so they go, you know, we're not a, like a couponing site or an email or any other way to close the loop. It's like, what do you do with it? Like, yeah, it's really different if you're a cable company or a telecom, because they can close the loop, you know, on an ongoing basis. But consumer brands have never been able to. And that's where I see retail media coming in, because this gives brand marketers the ability to become performance marketers, and you sort of can't unsee ROAS.
So when we're talking about like Target Roundel or what Walmart is building, like they have a true closed loop opportunity now, you would say.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. Because it's like, okay. And it's, you have to deal with sort of, you know, frequency, you know, reach overlap, which is sort of a different, you know, subject, but all of these are sort of operating on the thesis of like, okay, hey, if you buy, you know, this advertising, we can tell you, you know, what happened, you know, X days, you know, X minutes, X weeks, you know, X hours, you know, later, you know, as opposed to having to wait for, you know, an MMM study, you know, 6 months later. So it's tightening, you know, sort of the look back window, and increasing, you know, the increasing end, so you can sort of make decisions faster, because you get more feedback.
So one more question before we take a break for our sponsor, but do all of these retail media networks, despite this true closed loop opportunity, do they like have a chance? By which I mean, like, how big is the opportunity? Like, how much of the digital retail media market can any one of these smaller ad networks grab? You know, like Marriott is big, it's Marriott, but it's just sure. Marriott.
Retail is inherently fragmented because of the physicality of the store. And so it's sort of like there's not going to be a Google within retail, because like the physical store. And so, and then that's an exponential problem when you start looking multi-country. So I actually think there's a, like, just as there are a gazillion, you know, regional grocery stores, you know, there's Kroger, there's Piggly Wiggly, you know, there's Harris Teeter, there's Wegmans. Just those businesses thrive and have done very, very well, even in a low margin business. So I actually think there is a lot of upside here. And it's a matter of sort of how the brands, you know, engage. But if one of them dreaming of becoming Google, I don't see that happening.
I just did my own stupid thing and lumped Marriott in with everybody. That's that wasn't a good example, but thank you for running with it.
Yeah.
So we're going to take a quick sponsor break. And then when we're back, we're going to talk about Amazon. And then we're going to talk about Amazon. And then we're going to talk about Amazon. So stick with us.
I'm Sarah Sluice, executive editor of AdExchanger. And I'm pleased to welcome back Michael Katz, CEO of mParticle. Welcome, Michael.
Hey, Sarah. Good to see you.
So, Michael, describe the concept of data chaos to me and how it impacts corporations.
Yeah. So the value of data gets created upon activation. The problem with that is ultimately that The digital ecosystem is in a constant state of flux. Everything breaks. The data itself breaks, the data schemas break, the pipelines break, APIs break, ultimately the customer experience breaks, which nobody wants. And that happens as a result of all of the change, right? New laws and regulation, new rules thrust upon everybody by Apple and Google. You certainly saw this in iOS 14.5 and beyond. New vendors, new APIs, new landing pages, new app functionality, just everything. This kind of constant state of flux. That is ultimately data chaos. And so the opportunity around digital execution and activation requires that you don't treat all of these things that continuously break as like somebody else's problem. It is core to your execution as creating a great strategy to begin with. And it's an inevitable and universal phenomenon that all companies experience.
What is customer data infrastructure and how does it help with data chaos?
Yeah, so let's start with a few indisputable truths. So going back to activation, activation will only be as good as the quality of data that powers it. But that data quality inside organizations is in a steady state of decline, and it requires active investment to not only ensure that data quality remains in a steady state, but also improves. So that's the first point. Second, privacy and compliance needs to be integrated into your data flows, not treated as this process that happens after the fact. The difference is where risk goes to hang out. And then lastly, speed matters, right? Marketing in the moments that matter is ultimately the difference between success and failure. And so what is customer data infrastructure? It's a trusted data pipeline that helps you solve for data quality, data governance, and connectivity all in real time.
What should people know as they invest in new infrastructure and personalization?
Yeah, there's no one-size-fits-all approach. There's a lot of great reference architectures that people like to point to that are nice and symmetrical, and they look good, but the map is different than the terrain. Being able to move data from one point to another, one system to another, on paper or technically, isn't necessarily the same as doing it in a way that is highly incorporated into your go-to-market strategies, right? So think through data chaos. Think through what are the things that can break? How do you build resiliency and ultimately maturity into your organization? And don't think about like, well, what's the cleanest kind of architecture? What's the most appropriate architecture to be able to execute your digital strategies and accomplish your goals?
Thank you, Michael.
Absolutely.
Okay. So before the break, I feel like we spent a good, I don't know, like 15 minutes talking about retail media ad networks, whatever that means, without getting too deep on Amazon, even though we talked about search and lots of searches start on Amazon. But yeah, so last year, Amazon made more than $30 billion in ad revenue. So that makes it the number three largest digital ad company behind Google and Facebook. And then you compare that with Walmart, which I think is, you know, like right behind Amazon, but it made just over like $2 billion in ad revenue last year. So there's obviously this massive difference. I mean, Walmart is pretty much Amazon's biggest retail media competitor, and it's like $31 billion compared with 2-point-something billion. So, I mean, is there actually room for everyone? Before the break, you were saying, yeah, but it also feels like Amazon is just going to eat the world for like dessert.
They're ambitious. They think big, and I think sort of their culture of customer obsession and single-threaded owners and bias for action, sort of creates, you know, these new, you know, interesting, you know, products. And then there's a, you know, there's a nice, you know, network effect there. That said, I think there's, you know, there's a, you know, retail is so fractured. There's a place for, you know, lots of players here and lots of retailers, you know, to help here. And even sort of, as I think it's sort of almost in the aggregator level, somebody like Instacart, and being able to, you know, sort of, you know, look across multiple retailers, really great experience for the advertisers because the SKU permeates, you know, across the retailers. So if you, you know, sort of if you're shopping across multiple retailers and the SKU is in different retailers, like you know, the A&P, the automation and personalization, you know, will, you know, push forward across there. So, you know, I do think there's actually, I think it will stay fractured for a while. I just don't think that there's a way for it to totally roll up because of how fractured retail is.
So you brought up Instacart, but there are also what I would think of as a different critter, a different type of Amazon aggregator out there. So what do you think of those companies, these like holding companies of sorts for third-party Amazon sellers? Because they're raising a ton of money and they're also spending like a ton of money in the name of growth and growth and more growth.
Yeah.
But yeah, like, are they a quote unquote good thing? Will they end up crashing? Like, what's the best way to think about these companies?
I'm bearish on them in general. I think that folks, I don't think folks reported well that they most, you know, they raised a lot of debt and the debt had specific covenants around the EBITDA, to manage the businesses. And so they were able to sort of increase their CACs to acquire the business in, you know, increasing the multiples in the market. But once they then acquired them, because they were under constraints as far as how they operated the business, they didn't then have the dollars to drive the growth and investing in, you know, the various parts of advertising. That said, there is a play for stitching together, you know, sort of like brands, you know, efficiency within supply chain, you know, and driving value there, you know, sort of, you know, back office, you know, get collapsing there. But I think there will be plays for people that get, you know, specific domain expertise within certain categories that are able to develop interesting products, streamline the supply chain, whether that's domestic or coming in from China, and you know, have some really, really great businesses. But I don't think they're going to look like they currently do. I know as well as like getting these insurgent brands into, you know, into brick and mortar retail. Like one of the things I find sort of amusing in this industry is like everybody's talking about D2Cs. Well, they don't call themselves D2Cs anymore. They call themselves digitally native brands. Well, why is that? Well, because there's a glass ceiling on D2Cs and you only get so big and then they all go running to Target to get really big. And then they get distribution at, you know, at Walmart. And that's because retail works really well and customers like retail. And so, you know, in sort of a similar way, you know, with the aggregators and even, you know, Thrasio will say it on their, you know, their website, like part of their plan, you know, is to take these brands, you know, to retail.
Totally random question. What's in your Amazon cart right now?
Let's see. What did I last buy on Amazon? I updated my subscribe and save for Spindrift, which I'm somewhat addicted to, and paper towels and getting them delivered. So yeah.
I'm buying dish towels. That's all I have right now. Black dish towels. They're really cool.
Yeah. Yeah.
So, right, Amazon is eating the world, to go back to that theme, you know, et cetera, et cetera. And, you know, most product searches do start on Amazon and they probably do have what you want. But weirdly, although I think you've said to me in the past that it's getting better, product discovery in Amazon like isn't the best. So mm-hmm. like what is Amazon doing to make that better? And like as it gets better, how is that going to help boost Amazon's like ads business even more?
Sure. It's time on site. And so for the longest time, I think Amazon looked at it as, you know, time on site was friction. They want to decrease friction. They wanted people to, you know, search, click, buy, bounce. And because that was a great customer experience because you got what you wanted. I think what they've discovered over time is that, you know, dwell time is not necessarily indicative of a negative CX. It's actually a great complement to the site that customers want to, you know, discover stores and see how brands, you know, present themselves. They want to see posts and how brands talk, you know, socially. I've long, you know, sort of argued that ratings and reviews are the world's largest unacknowledged social network. And there's a buy now button right next to that. And so these are customers having conversations, you know, about products and back and forth, and the manufacturers can engage in those conversations. So I think all of those, you know, sort of point to increased dwell time. The increased dwell time gives additional opportunities for discoverability. And Amazon's just trying to figure out what's that right balance between sort of being, you know, sort of a transactional, you know, site to a discovery site. And so even like one of the things like I personally saw is because they rolled out the sold by name updated to say, visit whatever XYZ store. And like, I click on them more and more because like a lot of brands, like they suck at doing variations. And like I hit their product detail pages and I'm like, I can't believe you're twisting your products together like this. This is insane. But you go to the store and they know how to lay it out exactly like what the decision tree would be. And then, so anyway, so like I had to spend more time like browsing around and looking at it. But it's, you know, it is a process. And I think we'll see sort of more video, more ways to interact with brands. And as that happens, people will spend more time and they can then discover new products.
I will say that a lot of my time on site with Amazon, I feel like John Nash from A Beautiful Mind, where I'm just trying to figure out free shipping. Like it just takes forever. Like you add something and then suddenly free shipping has disappeared. So you take it out and you add something you weren't necessarily going to buy. And then you haven't reached the minimum yet. And I don't have Amazon Prime. No, I don't buy enough. I don't buy enough stuff online.
Prime makes it just like you just hit the button. John and I was a good or bad thing, but it works incredibly well.
Right. I mean, I will say, go ahead. Yeah.
Yeah. And I think also the thing with the Prime, like one of the things we've seen is sort of as their capacity, as they've gotten additional capacity back, you know, it's actually too much capacity right now, where it's like, again, if I look into the lens of like the ultra fast, it's like, okay, well, ultra fast, like, you know, they have how many SKUs? Let's say 10,000 maybe, you know, SKUs, you know, Amazon has millions and they can deliver within 4 hours. And so that sort of that combination of, you know, the world's largest selection plus, you know, great convenience, you know, that ends up being sort of, you know, and we end up seeing sort of as they then roll that out, like you used to call it the buy box, you know, fast track metric, you don't show it anymore, but you could see sort of as you would have that messaging on the buy box, how your conversion rate would increase because customers like knowing the certainty of it's going to show up and the rigor of their supply chain and how that, you know, is a customer delighter.
So, moving away from advertising for a minute, Edge just put out some research forecasting that Amazon is going to overtake Walmart as the biggest retailer in the US really soon, 2024. So considering that, like, how do you compete if you're Walmart, like, let alone anyone else? Like, how do you compete if you're Walmart?
They already are. And to me, it's like they're looking at their physical assets as a key advantage. And so, you know, I was talking earlier about, you know, have two kids. Well, you know, click and collect is magical. And so you no longer have to like go inside the Walmart to get that great value. You can just pull into the store and then order everything online. And then, you know, somebody brings it out, you know, in bags. And so you don't have to cart around kids, you know, within the Walmart. And so I think, you know, Walmart is incredibly good at, you know, the physical site selection. Many of it is visible from, you know, interstates. And so being able to show, you know, that you can, you know, pick up your groceries, you know, at that Walmart, is a game changer. And we saw that expressed, you know, as they rolled out the ability to purchase, you know, OPD, you know, within search, that, you know, the customer demand there, you know, skyrocketed. And if we look at, you know, the search behavior, you know, on Walmart, it's very concentrated within CPG, which to me says that, you know, customers, you know, absolutely love the ability to, you know, shop on their phone, and then, you know, pick up at the store.
So do you find it kind of annoying, I guess, that people frame it as a zero sum game, like Amazon, you know, versus everybody else? Cause it seems like that doesn't have to be the case. It's just like an easy headline.
It's a convenient narrative. And it's, you know, again, getting back to this, like the fractured nature of retail, it's like, you know, these are operationally incredibly well-run companies that are, you know, great competitors that make each other better because the competition is so high. That ultimately, I think, is good for the brand and you know, that, you know, advertise or sell through, you know, these platforms as well as the customer.
And what about Chinese brands on Amazon, like brands that originate in China, because they're growing like crazy, like 2 or 3x as fast as, you know, a lot of US brands. So, yeah, I mean, are Chinese brands going to eventually be some of the biggest brands on Amazon?
Some of them already are. Anchor is a great example there. Yeah. And, you know, and really, I see this as it is the Chinese manufacturing base, are becoming brand builders. And so, you know, what we're hearing from our colleagues in China, oftentimes the factory owners are now holding onto their best IP and launching brands and, and figuring out, what that go-to-market is and how they create that brand storytelling. If I'm a, US brand and I've outsourced all of my manufacturing to China, sort of like, how do I hang on, to, IP, how do I, and an existential question of what is a brand? How do I translate that within a product detail page? How do I talk about, the lineage and what goes into the, into the brands? And to me, that creates, great competition, and also sort of an interesting construct of, your competition is not necessarily who you think it is. It's not necessarily who is slotted next to you in Target. It's a much larger, cohort of auction participants, than necessarily what we'd see in brick and mortar retail.
Yeah. I mean, Anchor is a household name now.
Yep.
I mean, I'm using an Anchor cord right now.
Well, it's even more competitive in like the categories where you don't know the brands. So like CPG, you're going to know the brands because of how much they advertise, but like name like a brand for like garden space, you can't, like nobody can. But there's a gazillion of these, brands on Amazon. And so what is the expression of a brand? All of a sudden it's a title, it's a face out, it's ratings or reviews, it's ASP. So that's a very different expression of a brand than the face out on a shelf, and different competitors. And it becomes this real-time planogramming exercise. And it's a yield exercise, across these various sites and the yield, it could be expressed as, the GMV, the net PPM, the revenue generated by the advertiser.
I need to learn some of these acronyms. I'm not sure what they all stand for. I know.
Well, I always joke that it's like our business is not a media business. It's a retail business, that happens to buy a lot of media. And so it's very different. Like we care about like supply chain and purchase orders, UPCs and G10s and CPQ, whatever.
Yeah, fulfillment and shipping and all of that.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, back to the retail media phenomenon though, as a penultimate question, are we going to end up with like a million mini walled gardens? I mean, yeah, but it just feels like every other week there's a new one.
Why do you use the word walled garden? What does walled garden connotate to you?
It kind of feels like something with a moat around it. Like it's its own self-contained thing, like a little self-attribution. You can do the closed loop thing. It feels, like it has a little wall around the garden.
Yeah, but how's it different than retail? Like you walk into a Best Buy and you see an end cap and maybe you buy the Anchor charger that's there. And so to me, it's a continuation of retail. And actually, I would argue it's more open than anywhere else because you can see the POS. You can see like what purchase order did that retailer place. Like proof of performance is not a viewability metric. It's like did they place a purchase order? And so like, that is from a, people talk about like, probabilistic versus deterministic. I mean, like hell, if a truck shows up at like, my loading dock and they want a truck full of whatever widget I'm making, well, that worked pretty well. And so I think it's a, for brands, like this is like a game changer. And then you peel back a little bit further and you look at something like Amazon Marketing Cloud, where you can create, custom level, queries in a privacy, first way, to look at, multi-touch attribution, like down to a second, how long, conversions take, what happens with your D2C, how does that then, play out on Amazon? What's the LTV? What does it cost? What's a CAC, for somebody, looking back and building those brands? Like that information to me is not like a walled garden. Like that's like an open, field to go play in.
Patrick, I stand corrected. You've opened my mind to this open field idea. So we are out of time, but I do have a book related question. So you're sure. In a book club, and sometimes I ask people for streaming recommendations, but you're a big reader. So what are you reading right now? I know you have Aldous Huxley on the docket for your book club meeting, but what are you reading next or now?
What am I reading next? Well, we haven't decided on the next one. And one of them, somebody threw out the idea of reading Mouse, which I'd really like to graphic novel.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. I love Chris Ware and his graphic novels. And so reading Mouse would be kind of cool. I was reading Marilyn Robinson for a while and like read all of her stuff, but got halfway through Jack and haven't quite finished that. So like, that's the one that's open on my, you know, bedstand. She is wonderful. And she did a really wonderful interview with President Obama a few years ago. That's worth a listen to, but just a beautiful, beautiful writer.
So send me an email about joining your book club.
Okay, and... all right. Well, I don't know if press is allowed, but we'll I'll float it by everybody.
Okay, off the record.
Yeah, off the record. But yeah, we English majors need to stick together in the ad tech world. So yeah, I'll float it by everybody this evening.
All right, Patrick, thanks for being on the show, for the book recommendations, and for, you know, making my mind into the little exploding head emoji.
Thanks so much. Really appreciate the opportunity to chat.
This episode was sponsored by mParticle. mParticle believes that better data results in better decisions and better outcomes. mParticle can cleanse, visualize, and connect your customer data from any source or system to any API. Postmates, NBC Universal, Spotify, and Airbnb use mParticle to accelerate their customer data strategies. Visit mParticle.com to learn more.